Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here to break down the big ideas shaping our world, making them really accessible for you.
And today, we're tackling a huge economic puzzle, the incredible rise of the so-called Asian tigers.
It's a story that really needs a closer look, and our guide for this is Joe Studwell's fantastic book, How Asia Works.
Yeah, it's a really influential one. Studwell, he kind of cuts through all the noise, the cultural explanations, the complex economic theories, and asks a really direct, practical question.
Which is basically, how did places like South Korea and Taiwan go from being, you know, pretty devastated after the war to becoming these high-tech developed nations?
Exactly. While their neighbors, who often started in similar or sometimes even better shape, well, they kind of stalled out or got stuck in that classic middle-income trap.
Right. It's the difference between, say, building global giants like Samsung or Hyundai and staying stuck exporting raw materials or doing low-level assembly.
And Studwell's big argument is that this wasn't some kind of miracle. It wasn't luck. It was a specific, repeatable three-step formula, like a manual almost.
Okay, so let's get into that manual, the three steps: land, manufacturing, and finance. And the key takeaway seems to be that the winners were these developmental states that didn't just suggest policies, they really enforced them, ruthlessly sometimes.
Conditional support was crucial. But before we get into the mechanics, maybe we should say a word about Joe Studwell himself.
Good idea. Because he's not your typical academic economist, is he?
Not at all. He's a British journalist. Spent over 20 years living and reporting across Asia, mostly based in Beijing. He even founded the China Economic Quarterly.
So his authority comes from being on the ground, seeing what actually happened, combining that field work, you know, with looking at the hard data over decades.
Exactly. He's much more interested in what policymakers did rather than what economic models say they should have done. It gives his work this really pragmatic, often counterintuitive edge.
And it directly challenges that old conventional wisdom, right? The Washington consensus.
Oh, absolutely. The idea that the path to growth was always rapid privatization, deregulation, free markets above all. Studwell shows that the successful East Asian countries, well, they did pretty much the opposite in the early stages.
Okay, so if free markets weren't the initial answer, what was this deliberate strategic sequence they followed?
Right, Studwell insists it's all about the sequence and, critically, discipline. First comes land. Radical land reform to boost agricultural output.
Step one, fix the farms.
Step two, manufacturing. Build up export industries, but under, let's say, strict supervision. Protection, yes, but conditional.
Okay, land, then factories. What's third?
Finance. Keep the financial system under tight control, making sure it serves the first two stages, basically channeling money into building things, not speculation.
And the book really drives this home by comparing the winners, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, later China, with countries that, well, didn't quite make it in the same way. Places like the Philippines, Thailand, Malaysia.
Yeah, he shows how stumbling on just one of these steps could kind of derail the whole process.
All right, we'll dig into that first step then. Land, you said it's foundational, but maybe a bit counterintuitive.
Totally. Because Studwell argues land reform isn't primarily about social justice, though that's a benefit. It's fundamentally an economic strategy.
How so? I mean, wouldn't big mechanized farms be more efficient? That's the usual thinking, right? Economies of scale.
That's the common assumption. But Studwell uses data from all over the world to show it's often wrong, especially in early development. The key insight, his aha moment, is that small family farms, if the farmers own the land or have secure tenure and get some support, consistently produce more food per hectare than big estates or collective farms.
More? Why?
Motivation, basically. Smallholders farming their own patch will work incredibly hard to maximize yield from every square inch. They use intensive techniques. Large estates, often run by managers or absent landlords, just don't have that same drive for maximizing output per unit of land.
Okay, so break up the big inefficient estates. Give land to the tiller. This maximizes food production. What else does it achieve economically?
It hits several targets at once.
One.
One, you get food security, higher productivity. Two, these small farmers start saving money, which helps later. Three, you get a healthier, often better educated rural population. And four, this is crucial for the next step, you suddenly create a huge domestic market.
Ah, because these farmers now have income and they need stuff.
Exactly. They need tools, fertilizer, clothes, maybe a bicycle, basic consumer goods. You can't really kickstart manufacturing if there's no one at home to buy the first simple products.
That makes sense. You see that pattern in places like Taiwan after World War II, where they did really sweeping land reform.
Right? And then you look at the contrast, like the Philippines, they never really tackled the power of their big landowning families. Land reform was patchy, incomplete.
And the result?
A less productive agricultural sector, persistent rural poverty, and a much weaker foundation for industrialization. They essentially failed at step one.
Okay, so step one is nailing agriculture through land reform, creating that base of productive farmers and domestic demand. Then the state pivots to step two, manufacturing. The hothouse phase, you called it.
Yeah, the hothouse. Because the successful states actively shielded their new industries, infant industries, from foreign competition, using tariffs, subsidies, cheap loans. Standard protectionism, you might think.
But wait, isn't that usually a recipe for disaster? Doesn't it just create lazy companies selling overpriced junk to a captive domestic market? You know, cronyism.
It absolutely can be. And that's where Studwell draws a really sharp line between what he calls good protection and bad protection. The difference. Good protection was always, always conditional.
It's just a long line.
Performance. Specifically, export discipline. This is maybe the single most important concept in the book. If a company got state support, the cheap loans, it wasn't a free lunch.
Okay.
They were given aggressive export targets. Sell overseas. Compete on the world market. Mm. And if they failed to meet those targets consistently, the state pulled the plug, support withdrawn. No excuses.
Wow, so it's protection, but with teeth. Compete globally or lose your support.
Exactly. It forced these companies, like the giant South Korean cables and Samsung, Hyundai, LG, these huge family-run conglomerates, it forced them to learn fast, to improve quality, to cut costs, to actually become globally competitive. The state gave them breathing room, but also held their feet to the fire.
It wasn't just nurturing, it was tough love.
Very tough love. And you can see the difference when that discipline is missing. Studwell uses the example of Malaysia's national car project, Proton.
Ah, yes, Proton. I remember that.
It got decades of protection, subsidies, you name it. But there was never that ruthless enforcement of export discipline. It wasn't forced to truly compete internationally early on.
And the result?
It mostly sold domestically, remained relatively inefficient, the quality wasn't always great, and it ended up being a long-term drain on Malaysia's resources instead of a driver of broad industrial capability. That's the difference between a developmental state enforcing discipline and, well, a crony state just handing out favors.
That failure really highlights the importance of that export test. Okay, so you've disciplined the farmers through land reform, disciplined the manufacturers through export targets. What about the money? Step three, finance.
Right. If you've got agriculture humming and factories starting to export, you need to make sure the financial system supports that, not something else. Studwell's view is pretty stark. Finance must be the servant, the handmaiden of industry and agriculture, not the master.
What does that mean in practice? How do you stop banks and finance companies from just, you know, chasing the highest, quickest profits, maybe in property speculation or something?
You control them. The successful states used what economists call financial repression. Now, that sounds negative, but here it just means the state kept a tight grip on the financial sector.
How?
They deliberately kept interest rates low, channeled credit very specifically to targeted industries, the ones trying to export, and discouraged lending for consumption or speculation. They essentially made the financial system quite, well, boring.
Boring is good in this context.
Boring is good. The goal wasn't financial innovation or maximizing banking profits. It was mobilizing domestic savings and directing capital towards long-term productive investment in factories, technology, infrastructure, building real things.
Studwell warns heavily against opening up the financial system too quickly, doesn't he? Premature liberalization, he calls it.
He does. And he argues the 1997 Asian financial crisis was a tragic real-world proof of his point about sequencing.
How so?
Well, countries like Thailand, Indonesia, South Korea, to some extent, they had liberalized their financial systems quite rapidly in the early 90s, allowing foreign capital to flow in relatively freely.
And that caused problems.
Initially, it looked great. Lots of investment flowing in.
Yeah.
But much of it was speculative, hot money, short-term capital, chasing quick returns in stock markets, and especially real estate.
Right.
It wasn't primarily going into building long-term industrial capacity.
So bubbles formed.
Exactly. Huge property and stock market bubbles. And when sentiment shifted in 1997, that hot money fled just as quickly as it had arrived. Currencies collapsed, banks failed, economies were devastated.
But some countries weathered that storm better.
Yes. Taiwan and China, notably, had kept much tighter controls on their capital accounts and financial systems. They hadn't liberalized prematurely. Their boring financial systems, while maybe less exciting, were far more stable and insulated them from the speculative panic. It really highlighted the danger of getting the sequence wrong. Finance comes last.
That sequence really does seem to be the secret sauce.
It really does. Which brings us to the big overarching themes. Theme one is pretty clear. The myth of the free market, at least in early development. Success came from very active, strategic, and disciplined state intervention, a kind of pragmatic state capitalism.
Okay, theme one, state intervention. Theme two.
Sequencing is everything. You can't skip steps. Land reform first creates the base. Then disciplined industrialization. Then, and only then, gradual financial liberalization. Get the order wrong, and you likely fail.
Makes sense. And theme three.
This is crucial. Discipline versus cronyism. It's the difference between a state strong enough to impose conditions on businesses demanding exports, demanding performance, and a state that's basically captured by business interests, just handing out favors and protection without demanding results.
That sounds like a fine line sometimes.
It is. And that leads to the fourth thing, institutional capacity. You can have the right policies on paper, but they're useless if the state doesn't have the administrative capability and, importantly, the political will to actually implement and enforce them, especially the unpopular bits like withdrawing support from failing companies or powerful landlords.
You're right. It takes a strong, relatively autonomous state bureaucracy to pull this off.
Definitely. And Studwell packs the book with these really punchy ideas that stick with you. Maybe we can highlight a couple.
Yeah, let's do that. What's a key one?
Okay, idea one on land reform. The most important thing about land reform is not its social justice aspect, but its economic efficiency aspect.
Right, shifting the focus. It's not just fair, it's actually the best way to get the most food grown initially.
Exactly. Idea two, on manufacturing. Export discipline is the most important learning mechanism in economic development.
That really nails it. Protection gives you shelter, but only being forced to compete globally makes you genuinely good. Learning by doing, under pressure.
Precisely. And idea three is philosophy on finance. Financial systems in developing countries should be boring.
Huh. I like that. Keep it simple, keep it focused on the real economy, building farms and factories, not complex financial games.
Avoid the speculation, avoid the bubbles, at least until you're much further along.
So pulling this all together, what are the practical applications for us, you know, listening today? How can we use this framework?
Well, for anyone interested in business or investment in emerging markets, it gives you a powerful lens. Instead of just looking at GDP growth, you can ask Studwell's questions. Has this country sorted out its agriculture?
Is there real export discipline being enforced on protected industries, or is it just cronyism?
Is the financial system stable and focused on productive investment, or is it fueling, say, a property bubble with hot money? These questions help distinguish potentially sustainable growth stories from fragile ones.
And for policymakers, it's almost a direct challenge to the old liberalize everything now advice. It suggests a more patient, sequenced approach, focusing on building state capacity first.
Absolutely. Build the institutions, enforce the discipline before you fully open up.
And I think for all of us as citizens trying to understand the world, it's a reminder that economic success stories are rarely about pure ideology. They're often about pragmatic, sometimes tough, hybrid approaches. It wasn't just free markets. It wasn't just state control. It was a specific blend executed ruthlessly.
A very specific discipline blend.
Reflecting on this, what stood out most to you? What was the biggest surprise or takeaway?
For me, it was probably that initial point about small-scale agriculture being more productive. It really overturns a common assumption. Yeah, that's a good one. For me, I think it's the starkness of the sequencing argument. The idea that getting the order right is just as important, maybe even more important, than the individual policies themselves. Skipping steps, like jumping to financial liberalization, seems almost guaranteed to cause problems down the line according to this framework. It really requires long-term vision and political toughness.
Yeah, that political toughness. Which leads us perfectly into the final thought we want to leave you with. If Studwell's three-step formula land, disciplined manufacturing, controlled finance is known, and the evidence suggests it works, why don't more developing countries just, you know, do it?
And the answer, as Studwell powerfully argues, isn't really about economics. It's about politics. Implementing this strategy means taking on incredibly powerful vested interests.
Like the big landowners who don't want land reform, or the financial elites who profit from speculation, or the politically connected industrialists who want protection without discipline.
Exactly. It requires a state that is strong enough and autonomous enough to prioritize long-term national development over the short-term gains of these powerful groups. That's the real barrier. It's less an intellectual puzzle and more a raw political fight.
A challenging thought to end on. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accotra Foundation.